Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring myself, Mark Thompson, and Emma Burnell.
Hello.
Hi, Emma.
Hello.
Hi. So I'm a Lib Dem blogger and Emma's a Labour blogger, and we're going to do these regularly and basically talk about politics. We may have guests on from time to time, but sometimes it's just going to be us talking. I did used to be involved in a podcast with the same name as this a few years ago with Stuart Sharp. Stuart isn't directly involved in this anymore, although we may have him on as a guest from time to time. But it is essentially a continuation. So we'll see how it goes. Emma, we were going to talk initially about UKIP, Rotherham and the palaver that's happened about the foster parents who have apparently had the three children they were fostering taken away from them because they were discovered to have been shock horror UKIP voters. What do you think about this?
I think they're UKIP members. I think that is distinction to make. What do I think about this? It's very, very, very difficult. I have a lot of very complicated personal thoughts about this because I have very specific family reasons. I come from a family that adopted a mixed race child. So, and I'm aware of a lot of the complications that come with that, that people just wouldn't know unless they were inside one of those families.
We probably should just point out, actually, I neglected to mention that the children were actually of a mixed ethnic background and were actually European migrants, is that right?
Yeah, I think so. They said they were not Indigenous British, I believe.
Yeah.
I mean, I've experienced the racism that comes with being from a mixed race family. And I've experienced people being quite judgmental about that at times, both from black communities and white communities at times. Not very much. And, you know, my brother's my brother's my brother. I love him to bits. But having gone through adoption, or not myself, but been in a family that went through adoption, I'm very much in favour of placing children into families as soon as is possible. But I think there is a great deal of discussion that's happening here without very much reference to the professionals who made the decision. And if it turns out the decision has been made purely based on the fact that these people are members of UKIP, then for myself, I think that's ridiculous. I think it's overblown. I think it's completely unnecessary. They took on these children, were happy to have them. UKIP membership does not equal racism. Is there a Venn diagram? I'm sure there is, but it's not the same thing. If, on the other hand, that's just one aspect of a number of concerns about this couple that the professionals had, I would want to know that. I would want the right people to know that, not necessarily me as a gawping reader. But I'm loath to jump to judgment about the professional decision making, because I think we do that with people in social services far too often, and I think it causes tragedies.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with the last thing that you said there. I do think that there are sometimes, certainly within the media, a kind of knee-jerk reaction to decisions that are made by social workers. I mean, I wouldn't want to do that job. It's a very, very difficult job. And there is a fairly strong element of damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Yeah.
Because the times when social workers make the decisions to place children in families that turn out not to have been right for them in all kinds of different ways, yeah, ranging from just not right through to, you know, the child ends up being killed at their hands. I mean, you know, that has happened in the past. And, you know, like I say, it's a very difficult job, and I'm sure it's a difficult call. I think what inflamed this situation is the fact that Joyce Thacker, who I think was the councillor responsible for this, went on to the media, and she made some comments that did sound like she was saying that the decision was taken because they were UKIP members. Now, I don't know whether she's gone back on that or whether she misspoke or whether it was just more complicated, but she wasn't able to go into the further details. And I think that there's probably some truth in that, because I know I was listening to the radio yesterday, and there was someone on who I think was a social worker who was saying that they just legally, they cannot talk about the full details of this, so you may only be getting a partial picture. But I definitely agree with what you've said, that if this decision was taken on the basis that they are UKIP members, then that is utterly ridiculous. Because, you know, UKIP is a legally constituted political party. They've got 30-odd councillors. They've got 12 MEPs. They may well come first in the European elections in a year and a half's time. You know, they came second last time. Mm. The idea that being a member of that party should bar you from being able to foster children is utterly preposterous. I mean, I wonder what kind of investigations are going on now, because I feel like Michael Gove jumped the gun yesterday. He admitted that he hadn't seen all the papers and details associated with this, but then he was on the media saying that this was a terrible decision and all the rest of it. And I, you know, it's all very well for me to shoot my mouth off on a podcast, but he's the Secretary of State who's responsible for this, and I think he should have been more circumspect about this. But I think it sparked off an interesting debate about the whole situation. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would disagree with you that what sparked this off is simply the remarks by the councillor in charge. I think what sparked this off is the fact that there's a by-election in Rotherham.
Well,
UKIP members do quite well.
As I was saying those words, I did realise there was also a political dimension. But to be honest, I think if this had happened even outside of a by-election, I'm sure UKIP would have made as much political capital as possible out of it. It just so happens that coincidentally it's happened in the constituency where there's a by-election happening. I don't think this was contrived or confected by UKIP.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that that's why it's a national story that's going to run rather than, you know, tomorrow's chip paper sort of thing. I think that there should be a proper investigation. I think there is going to be investigation. I think Michael Gove should have waited for the results of the investigation. I think we have a problem where government ministers of all stripes are responding to 24-hour media rather than responding to the needs of their jobs. That happened under the last government. It's happening under this government. And I think it's something that needs to be properly addressed, and it hasn't been at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a real tension there because we do want our politicians to be answerable to us. We don't want them to be able to avoid the media, but equally, this kind of immediate reaction is unhelpful.
I attended an event just before the 2010 election, which involved Tom Watson, and something that he said stuck in my mind. He said that he was speaking to a government minister, and he actually asked them, you know, what's the most precious thing that you can have as a minister, you know, what's the most important thing? And apparently the minister responded, time. Time to be able to reflect. Time to be able to think things through, because apparently that just basically doesn't happen. Ministers are just, things are just thrown at them, they're expected to respond almost instantly, and it has got a lot worse in the last, you know, two or three decades because of the you know, the pace of the 24-hour media. I mean, you know, it did used to be that ministers and you know, cabinet ministers and even prime ministers could quite happily go off and have long holidays and not be expected to, you know, be responding to every news story, and that just doesn't happen anymore. I mean, you know, if a minister's on holiday when something that's part of the brief kicks off, you know, the media go nuts. Why are they on holiday? They should be back here sorting this out. Ministers regularly have to come back off holiday to sort problems out. And, you know, it's not like they don't have officials in their department that can sort these things out.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's true. And I've written before about being sympathetic to David Cameron, which I rarely am, need to have a holiday. It was just after the riots when he went back on holiday, and lots of people were criticising for that. I'm like, that's a really hard job. He needs a break. You know, he'll be better having had a break.
Yeah, actually, sorry to interrupt, but I was just going to caveat what I just said coincidentally about the riots, where I do think there was that one occasion when the riots were kicking off. He was on holiday and he initially decided to stay on holiday, and then it got worse and then he came back. And I did think he should have come back quicker, but that was an extreme situation where there was urban insurrection going on the streets of the capital and several of the cities. You know, that's different.
But I think also one of the things about the riots was that there had clearly been very poor planning about who was going to be on holiday, because you had the Prime Minister, the Mayor of London, and the Home Secretary all away at once. And
also I think the Chancellor, and I think Nick Clegg might have been on holiday as well. I think all the senior members of government were actually away at the same time. I think I blogged about that as well. I think that was pretty short-sighted.
Yeah, and I just think, you know, absolutely they should have a holiday, but it should be in the same way that in my office, within my team, we say, oh, if you're away that week, I won't be.
Mm.
And, you know, we're a small team. We can manage to do that. I think they could probably manage to do that at the top level of government. It really shouldn't take that much difficulty.
Yeah. Just to come back on topic slightly, though, an interesting angle on this that I heard on the radio both yesterday and today, actually, in two different phone-ins I was listening to, both posed the question, OK, so the general consensus from callers was essentially that if this decision was taken because these people are members of UKIP, then that's ridiculous. But the question was posed, what if they were members of the BNP?
Mm.
And a caller yesterday to LBC made a very eloquent case for if it was the BNP, it would still be ridiculous to stop them from fostering children. This person himself was from an ethnic minority. Like I say, he made a very, very strong case for it. He was basically saying they're a legally constituted political party and the decision should be taken on the basis of whether they are good parents or not, not what political party they're members of. But on another phone in, I heard someone say the exact opposite, which is that members of the BNP shouldn't be allowed to foster children. What do you think about that?
I would have real difficulty were I part of an adoption or fostering panel, which are made up not just of the social services professionals and local councillors, but also of lay members. My mother is a lay member of an adoption panel and has been for 20 years. Placing an ethnic minority child with someone who had not just voted BNP, but had taken the step to join the BNP, which has in its constitution, in its manifesto, you know, racist policies. So while they may be very loving to a child on a day-to-day basis, their political beliefs are to repatriate people who are not Anglo-Saxon, which would include the children they are being given to look after. I think that's too difficult a message for a young child to be able to live in. You know, I think that would be so there are, you know, when you're talking about fostering any children, there would be less conflict were that BNP couple to foster a child who was of the same race. But you are still putting a child into a situation where they will be taught beliefs that are extremely unusual and may lead them to be bullied, to be ostracised. And that's another thing that you have to think about in these situations. Not with UKIP, I don't think. But you have to consider the whole welfare of the child and their life outside of the home as much as their life inside the home. And if somebody is a open member of the BNP, there will be other members of the community who will find that very offensive and may filter through to the children.
Hmm. I mean, I think maybe there are a couple of strands to this that I'll pick up. I think the first one is that, I know for a fact that there was a BNP councillor about 2 or 3 years ago who, despite the fact that he had stood for election under the banner of the BNP and was a councillor, clearly didn't understand the BNP's policies because he was questioned about it, and it was pretty obvious straight away that he himself wasn't racist and he hadn't realised what the policies of his own party were. So I think there is always the possibility here that people aren't quite as clued up as you'd think, and, you know, maybe a member of a party without particularly understanding what that means. So I'm not saying that reflects well on them, because if you're going to join a party, you really should understand what the policies are. But I'm saying there are probably a number of BNP members who just don't realise how bad the party is. The second thing is, you know, being a good liberal, I do struggle with the idea that decisions should be taken on the basis of membership of a political party. I think insofar as possible, it should be taken on the basis of evidence of what those people do and, you know, and how they act and how they're likely to bring up those children.
One of those actions is joining a political party.
Yes.
So yeah, that is an action they have taken. They have taken the proactive decision to join a political party that is racist at its core.
Yeah. So there was a situation a little while ago where there was a woman who was a teacher in a school, and I think she was sacked or she was suspended because she was a member of the BNP, and there were fears that she would be teaching racist ideology to the children. Now I totally disagreed with that. She was a member of the BNP, but if she was able to separate out her membership of the BNP from what she taught, and as long as she was teaching to the syllabus and, you know, wasn't allowing her, whatever her beliefs were, to influence that, then she should be allowed to teach. Now,
if this
I appreciate
is the same
that's
case
a difficult
as I'm call. Remembering, I don't think the question was whether she'd be teaching racist ideology. I don't think she was bringing Mein Kampf into the classroom. But I think it was more a concern that in a multi-ethnic classroom, which it was, she was less able to support all the different children in the same way, and that was the concern.
Well, yeah, and I appreciate that there are always going to be subtleties in those kind of situations, but my concern is that the decision in that case was taken on the basis of what her political party was rather than what her actions were.
Well, and again, I bring you back to the fact that her action was joining that political party.
But no, I'm talking about her actions in the classroom. So how she teaches and how she interacts with the children. I think that is how that teacher should have been judged, not on the basis of what political party she was a member of. I do think that there should be a separation between those things. And in this case, so, OK, we're talking about UKIP, but let's say hypothetically there was a situation where parents were BNP members and they were looking to foster. I still think it should come down to a decision about them and their actions and their behaviour. And I appreciate it's not always going to be easy to separate those things out, but I think as far as possible a very good attempt should be made to do that, because otherwise you'll end up in situations where people are members of a party that, you know, for one reason or another, other people who are having to make a decision about something don't like, and they'll feel able to make decisions, well, I don't like that party, therefore you can't do this. I mean, that's almost where this is leading, and I'm very uncomfortable with that. You know, if a party is beyond the pale and is doing things that are illegal, then the party should not be allowed to exist. You know, it should be banned. You know, if it's like inciting violence or whatever, you know, whatever it take, you know, whatever would take the party beyond the pale and would cause it to be banned, that's a different thing. But if the party is legally constituted and people can join that party, then I'm very uncomfortable with the idea that that should then mean that there are certain things that they can't do in society that other people who are members of other parties or members of none would be allowed to do.
I would be equally uncomfortable with placing the child of a Somali immigrant with people who are members of the BNP. I just think that the, not just the belief system of the parents, but the people who they will be in their lives will make it very, very difficult for that child to have a decent upbringing.
I think you're assuming that everyone who's a member of a party lives and breathes that party. And
no,
I don't
not
think
at
that's
all.
True.
But I'm saying that if you go, so the only 1% of people in this country have gone so far, are political enough to put their money where their mouth is and join a political party. If you feel that strongly, i.e. you're the 1 out of 100 people who feel strongly enough to go and do that, then I think that you don't necessarily, I mean, I know plenty of Labour Party members who don't live and breathe the party at all, but you do have a certain amount of affinity with the basic ideals of that party. Now, that councillor who was a bit daft, I think they're the exception, not the rule. And I think I would be very, very uncomfortable with making lives, decisions about children's lives based on the fact that we might think people are too stupid to know what they're doing.
Right, OK. I'm not quite sure I quite understand that last point you've just made.
Well, just if, you know, where you say, oh, you can't assume that all BNP members know that the BNP is essentially a racist party, I think you can assume that most of them do.
No, I think that's a fair point. I mean, I was just picking that one out as an example, because I remember being quite surprised that someone could have got to the point of being elected as a councillor for a party and clearly not understand what that party was about. I'm just saying, people aren't necessarily as clued into what a party is about and is, you know, and its policies are, as perhaps me or you are about our own parties and probably other parties as well. And it is just worth bearing that in mind, that membership of a party does not equal, it does not mean the same thing to everyone, I guess, is what I was saying.
I don't think it means the same thing to everyone. I don't think everyone is an activist. And that person who's been elected may well have, you know, had that arm-twisting conversation that lots of people have had, where, oh yeah, you'll never win, just stand, be on the ballot, be on the ballot.
Yeah. Well, we've all seen that.
Which, you know, may well explain why they ended up in that situation. But I think that if you're talking about placing a child who is of a different race, a child who would, under the BNP's policies, be encouraged to leave the country, to repatriate themselves at the very least, with people who have not just voted BNP, because, you know, there may be many reasons why someone would have once voted BNP and then have changed their mind. There are some great examples of people who've been extremely active in the fascist movement who've changed and gone completely the other way, but have actually and are currently have taken the strong step, the 1 in 100 step of joining the BNP, and placing that child who has, you know, quite, there are needs that come with placing a child of a different race in a family. You know, this is something that we experienced. You know, you have to be sensitive to that. You have to understand that there are issues that go along with that. I mean, it was easier in Hackney because practically everybody's with somebody from a different race. But when my parents moved to Hertfordshire, I'll never forget my brother saying to my mum when we were at McDonald's one day, so everyone's looking at me, they think I'm mugging you, mum. And you know, that is always there. It's not always thought about. We think about it very rarely, but it is something that has to be considered by the parents. And I'm not sure that's something that people who have taken that active step to be BNP members are going to be able to consider appropriately.
Okay. I think we're probably not going to agree on some of the details there, but I think we should probably move on to something else now. So you wanted to talk about some comments that Nadine Dorries made. I didn't actually see these, so maybe you can fill me in.
Well, she had a piece, I think it was on Conservative Home today, saying that the MPs in particular who have criticised her for going to the jungle were essentially being very sexist and would not have criticised a man for the same thing and in the same way. And it struck a chord with me, but I thought it was quite interesting because I thought sort of two things at once. First of all, I thought there was plenty to criticise about what you did and your behaviour in doing it, and your behaviour in general for your Conservative colleagues, although we all think she's great for the way she talks about Cameron, less great for the way she talks about just about anything else. But equally, I do think she's got a point that the kind of criticism that she got was gendered, and did have a sort of sense of that silly, hysterical woman kind of attitude to it.
So have you got any examples? Did she give any examples of the sort of thing she was talking about?
I'm trying to remember. I'm sorry, I don't have the piece in front of me. I can try and pull it up. You'll hear a lot of clicking while I do.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to say, just while you're doing that, I criticised Nadine Dorries for her decision. I thought it was a ridiculous decision. I don't think MPs should be going off to be on a reality TV programme whilst they're supposed to be, you know, serving their constituents and or voting in the House. And it's nothing to do with her gender. I was equally as critical of George Galloway when he went into the Big Brother house in, I think it was 2006. I equally thought that was ridiculous. And I think his arguments for doing so were fairly similar to Nadine
Indeed.
Dorries.
No, I absolutely completely criticised her for what she did. I think it was a daft thing to do. But I think that some of the tone of her criticism has been sloppy, in being unnecessarily just sort of putting her down for things that are that you wouldn't necessarily. It's let's say someone had gone off to do something quite different. I don't think there would have been the kind of hysteria that there was around Nadine Dorries. And I think she invites that in that she really enjoys a ruck, and she enjoys being her sort of role as thorn in Cameron's side. But I would want to separate the fair criticism of an MP who's drawing a salary should not take time out of their work time when they have perfectly generous time off to go and do to earn more money pissing about in the jungle.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be some element of truth to this. I'm sure some of the criticism of her, was pushing, going along the lines of, of being sexist, chauvinist, and yeah. Whatever else you want to use to describe it. Because frankly, any time that women in politics do things that are controversial, there is usually someone somewhere who will come out with some kind of comment that I'll kind of, I'll have a facepalm moment when I read.
Yeah.
Because, it's not like there isn't enough to criticise usually in these situations without going down that road. And actually, it's wider than that. Because even when politicians are just get coverage in general, female politicians. I'm just thinking the Spectator Awards this week.
Mm.
I didn't see them, but I read a précis of Fraser Nelson's comments. He kind of introduced each section.
Yeah.
And he made some reference to Theresa May being in kitten heels. I can't even remember the exact context of it. And it was complimentary.
Yeah. It always is.
Yeah, it was like, some kind of strong minister in kitten heels. It was almost like a kind of literary juxtaposition or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the same thing, I think Liz Truss either must have won an award or was presenting an award. Mm. And I saw someone had tweeted a link. I don't think it was someone from The Spectator that tweeted this link, but it must have been someone who was involved with the awards who took the picture, because it was taken from, as far as I could tell, behind the podium. And it was just Liz Truss's legs. And she had some tights on, and they were really nice tights with a kind of flowery pattern on them. And someone had tweeted, nice pattern, Liz, or something.
Mm.
What the hell has that got to do with anything? I'd much rather have known what she was winning the award for, or what she was presenting the award for. I mean, she's an up-and-coming minister. I think she's going to be a very important person in this government when it comes to childcare. She seems to have done a lot of work on it in opposition. And she's gonna be heading up that agenda in government. That's what I'm interested in, not what her tights look like, even though I'm a heterosexual bloke and her legs look really nice. But that's not relevant to this at all.
It's like any political interview you ever read, right? A political interview with a woman will always set the scene with what she's wearing, always. And on any whoever the writer is, it's always... and she sat back in relaxed in her chair in her cashmere jumper, with her grey slacks, from Manono Blahnik or wherever. Sorry, I had no idea about labels. And you always, always, whether they're an attractive or unattractive, whether they're old or young, whatever it is, if you read an interview with a political woman, the scene setting will always involve their clothes. Whereas with a man, it will generally, he's strode into the room forcefully. You get a sense of their activity rather than what they're wearing.
Mm. And I think that's what that Everyday Sexism Project's all about, isn't it? Just kind of pointing out how this stuff is so culturally embedded that if you're not concentrating, you don't even really notice it, because it's just kind of become part of the background furniture of the way these things are reported now.
I mean, I am editing the Shifting Grounds blog all of next week as a guest editor.
Oh, I should have said, actually, we're recording this on the 25th of November, just as a reference in case anyone's listening to this next week or next month or something.
What I'm doing is, we're running just women writers all week. And I have more than they would normally have in a week. I have an extraordinary array of writers, some of whom write on a regular basis, some of whom write less regularly, some new writers. And, what I'm not doing is having every single piece be about women's issues. Yeah, there are some and important things that we're covering that are gendered issues, but actually I'm having a woman write on economics, a woman write on defence, women writing on housing, on, you know, law and order. So making sure that there are female voices that are experts in these areas, which happens so rarely. And you know, one of the campaigns that I've got very involved with is ensuring better gender representation on political panels.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've seen that there's the Women's Room project that arose from just endless all-male contributions on the Today programme. And I think there were two in a row, one of which was on breast cancer and the other of which was on female contraception, where all the contributors were men. And it was like, okay. So I think that's kind of really exemplified the problem. And, yeah, whenever I talk about this, people always come back to me, men always come back to me, saying, oh, it should just be about the expertise, it should just be about who's the best person to talk on any topic.
Yeah, but that's just bullshit, though, because who decides who the relevant people are to speak on these topics?
Exactly. And, you know, what happens is people who went to school to each other, with each other, know their mate who can come and talk about it, and it's a bloke.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I went to the Labour Women's Conference last Saturday. An array of amazing, interesting, really exciting Labour women, again, of all ages, all races, that were talking there and were talking amongst each other. We've got these women who will be writing for my blog. For the Shifting Grounds blog, not my Scarlet Standard blog. Anyone who thinks they can't find women, if not looking hard enough, they're not trying hard enough. And actually, they are responsible then for the gender balance, the lack of gender balance in our politics.
Yeah.
You know, I was an events manager. I did it for 2 years and never ran a panel that didn't have a woman on it. It's just not that hard.
Yeah. And there are too many examples still. I mean, I only really have direct experience of Lib Dem conference because I've never been to either of the other two main parties conferences, but there are occasions when I've gone to fringe events and there have been all men on panels, and it's a bit dispiriting to see, because you kind of think, okay, how hard have you tried here? Is this just the usual suspects? But there was one very uplifting fringe event I went to, which unfortunately I couldn't stay till the end of because I had a prior engagement, but I saw the first half of it, and it was the chair was a man, but then there were just two speakers, and they were both women, and they were both young women as well, and it wasn't like it was this was the thing, the fringe event wasn't about women's issues.
Yeah, well, that's
it wasn't
the
like
thing. Go on.
Well, I was just going to say it was about the two different two different bodies within the party, so the Social Liberal Forum and Liberal Reform. Mm. Social Liberal Forum is sort of on the left-ish, and Liberal Reform is more sort of classical liberal. And they were just representatives of both of those strands of thought within the party. They just happened to both be young women. Mm. It was Charlotte Henry and Kelly Marie Blundell, both of whom I rate very highly. They're very good speakers, and they're very, you know, they're highly active in the party. And it was just great to see. You know, it's a pity we don't see more of it, but it was great to see on that occasion.
I mean, one of the things that is the Labour Party uses all women shortlists in order to ensure more women representatives in Parliament. Now, it's quite interesting, actually, in the recent controversy in Rotherham, people think that was an all-women shortlist because the two final candidates were women. But it wasn't. Mm. It was an open selection. Men were able to go for it. It's just that the two people who were, for whatever reason, I don't think now's the time to go into it, put on in the end, were women. And actually, this argument that all-women shortlists cut out talent, if you look at the shortlist we have for Bristol West, we had an absolutely incredible set of amazing, talented, high-achieving, high-flying women, who any one of whom, if they got that selection, would represent that seat incredibly well. And in the end, it went to a local woman called Sangam Debonair, who's, you know, been a local activist for many years. She's,
what a fantastic name!
It is a great name, isn't it? And so, yeah. But you also had Yeah, Gemma Tumulty, who works at the TUC, she's, you know, really sort of strong campaigner. You had Jo McCarron, who was from Bath. She'd been a really good local activist down there. And, Emily Robinson, I think her name was, who'd worked for the Equality and Human Rights Commission. So you cannot tell me that that wasn't an incredibly talented shortlist.
Yeah, I mean, I do have problems with all women shortlists. Not necessarily because I don't think, you know, that you're not going to get good people coming through from that. I just would prefer to see this done in another way, because I fear that there is too much of a risk of it being perceived as a kind of tokenistic process. However, I do understand, I mean, particularly with my own party, that we've tried other things, and let's be honest, with mixed results.
Well, I think mixed results is being very polite.
Okay. I actually did a blog post about this for Lib Dem Voice earlier this year, because we don't have enough women MPs. We only have 7 women MPs out of 57 MPs. It's not good enough. But I actually did an analysis on if we'd have won 100 seats, you know, so basically, how many women did we actually have in what we thought were winnable seats before the last general election? The story was a lot better. It still wasn't perfect, but it was more like about, I think it was about 25 or 30%. We were very close to the percentage of female MPs that Labour have. What that demonstrated, though, is that in the safest seats, in the seats we were most likely to win, they were mostly men. And unfortunately, I think this is a kind of legacy, almost kind of bed-blocking issue, where you've got men who've been in seats for many, many years. And what we need to make sure is that as we move forward and as more seats become available, that, you know, women have equal chances. And I know there is work going on in the party to try and make that happen. Just when you look at the headlines, it looks worse than if you look slightly below the surface. There is some good stuff going on. And I am optimistic that over the course of the next 5 or 10 years, it will get better.
I hope so, for your sake, but I'll be quite honest, I don't think it's going to, because I've been hearing this from Lib Dems for a really, really long time now, and every new thing that they try that isn't quite actually just, you know, let's just bite the bullet and do it. It's always, you know, with lots of encouragement and lots of... But I don't think it's the women that always need the encouragement. Sometimes it's the constituency and the parties that, when they close their eyes and think of an MP, they think of a man. And actually, it's the work that needs to be done at more local levels. And I believe in all women shortlists for now. I think they're a necessary tool until we get to the point where they make themselves obsolete because we change what politics looks like.
Yeah, I can understand the argument for it. I think in the Lib Dems it's particularly difficult because things like all women shortlists are perceived as illiberal, and it really does rankle with me, the idea that you would have to have a process like this. Now, Nick Clegg has actually said, he said when he first became leader, that he was willing to try other things, but if it came to the crunch, he would bring in all women shortlists. He actually said that. Now, I don't know how far we are from whatever threshold he set himself. Maybe he's forgotten he said that and he's too busy being Deputy Prime Minister now. I don't know. But I think he'd have a bit of a battle on his hands if he did want to do that.
Your other problem is that some of your women are in really... You may lose women at the next election. You know, both... if you look at the voting breakdowns in Lynn Featherstone's seat, in Sarah Tether's seat... For the London mayorals,
is Sarah Tether still in the Lib Dems? I heard a rumour she was defecting.
You keep her, mate. All right.
We should just say, in case anyone wasn't aware, there were some rumours a couple of days ago, but it all came to nothing. It was nonsense, basically.
No, I think we're sighs of relief all round over here. Trust me. I'm sure we've all had to have been very polite, but it would have been a struggle. Yeah, so Sarah Tether's seat, Lynn Featherstone's seat. I did some analysis on Lynn Featherstone's seat after a piece she did on Lib Dem Voice about the Lib Dems taking back Haringey Council. Mm. And on Haringey Council, where it was a breakdown by party, so, you know, you've got the... Because obviously in the London mayoral, I don't know how much you know about because you're not a London-based, but you vote for party and you also vote for the mayor.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. Yeah.
So, where it was votes by party, there was one ward where the Lib Dems came third. In every other ward, they came fourth. And where there were candidates, half of the wards in Lynn Featherstone's seat, the Lib Dems came fifth, because Siobhan Bonita had, you know, beaten them, who was the sort of viable independent candidate. So yeah. I think you've got real problems, and you need to think about resourcing the women that you have and trying to ensure that if men are stepping down from your safe seats, as you say, you're selecting women, because at the moment you may be running to stand still.
Well, no, I think what we should be doing is doing everything we possibly can to encourage women to stand. And I know that that is happening. Now, I'm not one of these die-in-a-ditch people. I think if in another, say, 5 or maximum 10 years, the gender balance of our parliamentary party is as bad as it is now or worse, then we may have to do something like this. But I want to see more strenuous efforts made to do it in a way that isn't forcing all women shortlists on constituencies before we get to that point. And I'm still willing to wait a bit longer to see. But like you, I definitely agree that we need to do better. Just briefly on the point of Lynn Featherstone and more broadly, you know, seats in general, I do think that one of the things in the Lib Dems' favour is just how strong some constituencies like Lynn Featherstone's and others are in terms of Lib Dems on the ground actually, you know, fighting to obviously to initially win the seat and then to keep the seat. And I think you may well find that there's a bit of a kind of incumbency effect.
I'm sure there will happens. Be. I think there'll be an incumbency effect. I don't know how strong it will be.
Well, I know Lynn Featherstone is out all the time in her constituency, knocking on doors, speaking to people. A couple of friends of mine used to actually live in her constituency, and one of them called me up and said, I've just seen Lynn Featherstone down the supermarket. It's just like, you know, she's just out and about all the time doing stuff. And, you know,
shopping.
I think, no, she was out campaigning. She definitely was. And, you know, this is what Lib Dem MPs do all the time, because they have to, because there aren't really any safe Lib Dem seats. And even if they seem safe, you know, there's too much of a history of how much of a battle the MP had to do to get there in the first place. And there are plenty of near misses as well. I mean, Bridget Fox in Islington South and Finsbury, Ed Fordham in Glenda Jackson's constituency, Kilburn, I think. You know, they all came really close at one point or another, and just, you know, just for whatever reason, haven't quite managed to make it. I realise Ed Fordham's a bloke. I'm using examples of, you know.
I think you're right. I think you have got incumbency does have its advantages until it doesn't. We shall see at the next election.
I think that is one of those ones we're going to have to put a pin in, because I'm basing this on history, and actually we're in completely uncharted territory here, and it may well be that the incumbency effect has very little effect at all, because,
or even goes, you know, against you, because now there's a record that you're running against, if you see what I mean.
Possibly. We'll have to wait and see on that. Just before we finish, because we did say we'd try and keep this to 45
yeah.
minutes, I think we'll probably go slightly over, but I did just want to talk briefly about Leveson, who's going to report this coming Thursday.
Yeah.
So depending on when you're listening to this, he may or may not have reported. I just wondered, what are your predictions? What do you think he's going to say?
Well, what I've heard is that somehow, and I don't know how, he's going to try and separate the public interest from the public purience. Purience? Sorry, I can't say that word. I'm from Hackney, you know. and, you know, so the public interest defence won't work in you know, snapping celebrities up their dresses shots, or writing you know, nasty stories about things you found on a celebrity voicemail, but it will protect the kind of investigative journalism that exposes government corruption, government failure at all levels, you know, local, national, and corporate.
So he's going to have his cake and eat it, basically.
Well, this is what I've heard. Yeah, there is going to be a separation of these two things. That won't be his cake and eat it, because the press won't accept any regulation without a massive, massive fight. So the one thing I do predict is there's going to be a almighty Barney. Cameron probably won't go that strong. I think there are enough Cameron allies that Michael Gove, Jeremy Hunt, you know, these are people who he promotes, who he likes, who are going to be telling him not to do anything at all and to give the PCC one more chance. I suspect Labour are going to back Leveson to the hilt. You know, they were pushing for it very hard. I don't know which way the Lib Dems will go, because I think there is a genuine conflict again. This liberalism, these ideas, two conflicting ideas of liberalism, may well come to clash.
I mean, I don't really see how Leveson can report anything that has any real teeth without there being at least a statutory element to it. And that seems to be what the main debate has been about in the last few weeks. You know, is it going to be voluntary? Or is it going to be policed by an independent body? Or is there going to be an underpinning of statute to this so that there is a legal obligation to abide by whatever rules you come up with? And I think it's going to have to end up being a mixture of independent body, however that is constituted, but with a legal underpinning. Because what you can't have is what we've got at the moment, which is a PCC, which nominally the papers sign up to. And I'm not even going to go into the argument about the fact that it's made up of patsies from the press who basically don't regulate it, because that's a given. We all know that, and that has to change. But, you know, people like Richard Desmond can just decide, I'm going to take my papers out of the PCC and I'm not going to bother. That has to not be allowed anymore. There has to be a way to stop that. And as far as I can tell, the only way that's going to work is through statute. And don't get me wrong, I don't like the idea that politicians will be deciding how to regulate the press. And so I want that to be as far removed as is possible to be and still be statute. So I sort of want my cake and eat it on that as well. But there has to be some kind of legal underpinning. And another thing I would love to see, I'm not sure Leveson will do this, but I would love to see that if a paper publishes something that is wrong about someone, then the apology has to be as prominent as the original story. I would love to see that, because the effect of that will be that they will stop doing it, because they will be so embarrassed about having to publish a massive apology in headlines on the front page every few days that they'll learn pretty quickly, you know, just like with a dog, you know, when you're teaching a dog not to do his business on the carpet, you rub his nose in it a couple of times and you kick him outside, and pretty soon that dog realises not to do it. And I'm sorry to come up with such a crude analogy, but, you know, they have never learned. And I just think that it's going to take something like that. But I'd be surprised if Leveson came up with anything as specific as that, to be honest. You know, I'd love to see it, but I'll be very pleasantly surprised, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not entirely convinced that we're going to get anything much of anything at all. I suspect that it will be thrown into the long grass, and there'll be a commission on implementation and all those other tricks that they do to not make a decision. Because if it were to go through, I'm just thinking in terms of parliamentary timetable, the rules would come into force just before the election. That would be about right.
Yeah,
I would imagine. I really don't think Cameron's going to want to do something that's going to piss off the entire press months before the election.
Do you know what I want someone to do? And if I had the time, I'd do it myself. Juxtapose whatever speech Cameron makes in response to the Leveson report with the speech that he made in the House of Commons last year, at the height of the hacking scandal, because I was in the Strangers Gallery when he made that speech, and he was very, very impressive. And I found myself almost punching the air saying, yes, come on, we have to do this. And I am sure his response this week is going to be a million miles away from what he said in the middle of that firestorm, because we know what Cameron's like. When his back's against the wall, he comes out fighting, but he's very inconsistent, and he will just say whatever he thinks he needs to say to get himself out of whatever hole he's in that day. And I expect that there are going to be some pretty glaring contradictions in his approach. Probably nothing that you could actually say, you know, here's an absolutely definite contradiction, but I think, you know, we know how to parse political speak, don't we? So I suppose we'll look at it and think, that's not what you said last year. Yeah. But just if we could get the two, just, you know, someone could edit out the clips and just show them against each other, I'd love to see that. Mm.
Well, it would be an interesting experiment. I mean, there's something to be said for that. Whether he thinks that the shame of changing his mind, doing another U-turn, will be greater politically damaging, would cause greater political harm to him than annoying the entire press, is yet to be seen. I think Labour have already annoyed the entire press by going for it, so they've got nothing to lose, to be honest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very, very interesting. And, you know, if there is to be some sort of legislation, there will be those campaigning against it. And we might see, I mean, Boris will be, we might see some interesting manoeuvring, political manoeuvring on the back benches.
I think Boris is backing the wrong horse here. I think he's usually quite astute, but I think he can't see the wood for the trees on this one because he's of that world.
Yeah. Well, and also I think that there just seems to be less of an understanding of how much less power politically the press has than it used to have. It still has some, and it shouldn't be denied or forgotten about, but it just doesn't have the kind of muscle it had when everybody read a paper every day.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And, you know, I wonder if Leveson's going to try and address blogging and social media. I hope he doesn't, because I suspect he doesn't really understand it. Yeah. But I think we probably need to wrap things up because we've gone on for just over 50 minutes.
Okay.
We said we'd try and stick to 45 minutes. So, but we can pick this up probably next week.
Well, we'll actually know something.
Yeah, so we'll actually be able to base it on what he's actually said rather than wild speculation.
We'll have to put an apology up front about being wrong about Leveson.
Maybe, and it's going to have to be as prominent as the original statement. So, yeah, you know, we'll kind of have it in the last few minutes just tacked on like this one. All right, well, thanks for coming on, Emma.
Thank you.
And we'll do this again next week, and thanks to everyone for listening.